when I was walking past Poly Pavilion, I saw the water rushing down the stairs, and I actually had to run through it to get back to my dorm, which I couldn't get back to just yet because the firefighters stopped us. So I was knee deep in water, had to take my shoes off even though they still got soaked.
UCLA student Aaliyah Rick speaking to NBC 4 News here in L.A. Yeah, a big water main break in Westwood yesterday. And for a while, Sunset Boulevard looked like Old Faithful, sending millions of gallons of water flooding nearby streets and UCLA. And wow, they were doing the breaststroke at Poly Pavilion, where UCLA recently finished a big renovation to the tune of $136 million. LADWP says the water main repair could take, quote, an extended period of time. In fact, they have not repaired the hole yet. Water is still leaking. Sunset Boulevard closed all day today and probably tomorrow. Well, this isn't the first water main break we've suffered here in L.A., and 5 years ago, there were more than 100 major breaks. Maybe you remember. So what kind of shape is our water infrastructure in, and how do we compare to other cities around the country? Charles Fishman is here now. He's a journalist and author of The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Hi, Charles.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, this water main that ruptured was almost 100 years old, and so installed in the 1920s when much of LA's water mains and pipes were installed. Is that too old, or is that typical?
Both, the answer to both those things is yes, it is too old and it is typical. In LA, I spent some time this morning reading the Water and Power Department's own information. This is one of the big pipes. There's 500 miles of pipe like this, and a third of those pipes are older than World War II, are 70, 80, 90, 100 years old. Overall, in the system, in your system, almost 30% of the pipes are 100 years old or older. On any given day, they're okay. But here's the interesting thing. The LA Water Department a few years ago released a 10-year capital plan, this sort of ambitious, let's fix the water infrastructure plan. Even according to that plan, you're only on a 200-year water pipe replacement cycle. So this pipe was 93 years old. Hey, maybe it was scheduled for replacement 37 years from now.
Oh my gosh. Well, how long are they built to last normally?
You know, the pipes that are 100 years old weren't built to last probably more than 50 years with a safe margin of 5 years. So this pipe doesn't owe anybody anything. Pipes that are installed today, I think, are installed with sort of the same kind of slightly modest expectation, 60 or 70 years, but the sort of unwritten understanding that they'll certainly go as long as the ones that are 100 years old because the technology's gotten better. The problem is that when you've got a big, relatively well-off American city that's on a 200-year replacement cycle for its pipes, no one is doing the right thing, replacing, you know, 1 mile of 200 miles or 30 miles of your 7,000 miles of pipe a year just isn't going to get the job done. Now, look, this is not uncommon. Here in Washington, D.C., where I live, is my favorite water main in the world. There's a water main under K Street, and K Street is the street that is home to all the big flossy lobbying firms in Washington. And that water main was installed 3 years before Abraham Lincoln became president. It's a full 60 years older than the one that broke in L.A. yesterday. So, you know, if you could sit in one of those beautiful conference rooms with the walnut tables and look at a slice of that water main, would it seem like it was time to replace it? Would you drink coffee from it? The problem is they're hidden. And if they're hidden, it's hard to get people to pay attention. And so the question is, can you use this event to sort of grab everybody's attention and start doing it differently?
Right. Well, does that go to the water quality? Is the water bad coming from these old pipes?
No, I don't. I think water quality in general is not something to worry about, although it's interesting. I wonder if that would make people happier about spending the money. Water systems are good at keeping the pipes clean. They're good at putting clean water in them. But if you look at what happened out in Westwood yesterday, literally tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in damage across the city and across the campus of UCLA, not to mention all of the inconvenience and traffic delays just from this one water main break. It would have been much, much cheaper to fix this water main, even given that you have to, you know, you have to rip up the street, you have to close that lane of traffic, all of that. We're just not being smartly thoughtful about doing this in an aggressive and determined way. Even if you double the pace, if you double the capital budget at the LA Water Department and you're on a 100-year replacement cycle, that's probably the limit. You know, you wouldn't want to drift much. That means you're literally going to start, you know, you'll replace pipes that are 100 years old 100 years from now. So you'd have to double the pace and double the spending to be anywhere in the right realm. But what's, you know, why not? What's a bigger priority than making sure the water keeps flowing?
I guess because we literally can't see the problem until there is a water main break. And I mean we by we, as in voters who vote people in and out of office, sometimes based on what they decide to spend their money on. And maybe we want to see them spend their money on something that is a little more visible, like repairing streets.
I think that's absolutely the problem. If you build schools, if you refurbish and update parks, if you clean beaches, if you repave roads, widen them, make them more effective, put in better, you know, traffic signals that are automatic, people appreciate that and they notice it. You don't get much credit for replacing water pipes, and in fact, the process of replacing them often is very disruptive. You have to rip up streets, you have to sort of block off businesses, you inconvenience people, it's dirty. That's why a moment like yesterday should be used to really launch an effective education program, an effective conversation. Here's why this happened. Here's what we need to do. We aren't hiding the money. We just don't have the money we need to do this. And then maybe you create a fee on your bottled water. Maybe you create a dedicated fee on the water bill so people know that $5 a month, that nickel on the bottled water is actually going to keep the water mains themselves in good shape.
Right. And plus the image of millions of gallons of water just spewing into the air and being wasted during this incredible drought is really something that is difficult to stomach.
Yeah, it was, as an aside, just a terrible event to have in the midst of the really serious drought you guys are experiencing. The water was leaking at 75,000 gallons a minute at one point. A family of four uses about 100,000 gallons a year. So you were losing in a minute what a family of four uses in about 10 months, which is, you know, just crazy. Now, you know, we didn't, quote unquote, lose the water. The water, you know, ultimately ended up back out in the Pacific Ocean. But we lost it in useful terms, and it had come a long way to get to that water main break.
And Charles, is there a way to figure out which mains are in danger, which pipes are in danger of cracking without digging up the street and looking?
Yes, LA actually uses some of that technology, and the technology gets better and better all the time. To look at they've got, you know, somewhere in the water department, there's a map of the 7,000 miles of water mains and the 500 miles of big ones, and you put a camera through and look at them. You can also send electrical signals along the edges of the pipe and see what condition it's in. It's not perfect. It's not like X-raying your left arm to see if it's broken or not. But there are lots of ways that didn't exist even 5 years ago, so that you can't replace all 500 miles of big, I mean, that is big water main. You can't replace all 500 miles of those just because you want to, but you can prioritize. You can say these are the places. This particular pipe, they wouldn't tell me whether it was scheduled for repair, but if you read the 10-year report, it was exactly the kind of pipe that was a high priority 4 years ago. So it wasn't that high a priority because it didn't get replaced.
Charles Fishman, journalist and author of the book, The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Charles, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, were you at UCLA yesterday when that all went down? Do you have pictures? Tweet at us. Tweet your pictures at us at KCRW Press Play, or maybe you're there now and can take a few snaps at KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, news from overseas. Pretty grim this summer. Wars erupting from Ukraine to Iraq to Gaza. So what's the United States doing or not doing? How has our foreign policy affected what's happening in these conflicts? That story next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
This is the third straight day of airstrikes in Gaza.
U.S. President Barack Obama has warned Russia that any military intervention in Ukraine would lead to
a new crackdown in Egypt. Could civil war be next for this key U.S. ally? Is there anything America can do to stop?
Iraq is asking the U.S. for airstrikes to help stop the onslaught of predominantly Sunni Muslim insurgents.
Secretary of State John Kerry is planning to intervene personally in a crisis that threatens the democracy that the U.S. fought for in Afghanistan.
It seems the world is falling apart this summer. There are serious conflicts in Iraq, Ukraine, Syria, Libya, and, of course, Israel. And America seems to be mainly watching from the sidelines. So what can or should the U.S. do? How has President Obama's foreign policy affected what's happening in these countries? Joining us now to discuss this is Aaron David Miller at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
And David Rothkopf. He is editor of the Foreign Policy Group. Hello. All right. So is it my imagination or is it worse this summer than it usually is?
I think there are a lot of conflicts in the world, but let's give it some perspective. We certainly do not live in a period that is as dangerous as the Cold War, where we lived with the threat of thermonuclear conflict and planet-wide destruction. We certainly do not live in a period that is as dangerous as either of the two world wars that dominated the last century. And so we need to recognize that while there's a lot of volatility around and a number of humanitarian catastrophes and a number of wars that we really need to pay attention to because they affect our interests, this is not the high point in that regard.
I mean, you have a world that's cruel and unforgiving and with a lot of moving parts, and most of the conflicts and confrontations you've mentioned don't have comprehensive solutions. They have outcomes. And the real question is whether or not a very risk-averse president can help shape those outcomes in a way that's consistent with American interests. I'm not terribly optimistic. I think that that risk aversion combined with the nature of the problems that the United States now confronts has made it very difficult to apply conventional diplomacy or the conventional projection of American military power. I've watched this movie now. I worked for half a dozen Secretary of State over the last 25 years or so. I just think the world's a much more cruel and unforgiving place, and American options are much more limited. I mean, I'm not a declinist. I'm not suggesting we are a potted plant, but I think there's serious constraints on what it is we can do.
And David Rothkopf, is this at all an outcome of, as Aaron David Miller was saying, a cautious president who does not want to get involved in a lengthy and entrenched adventure in any foreign country at this point?
Well, look, I think the president bears some degree of responsibility, but he's not, you know, exclusively responsible. All presidents have to deal with the hand they're dealt worldwide. He's had some bad luck in terms of some of the international situations. We're also at a moment where essentially all the major powers in the world are not really ready to engage. Europe is going through or has been going through an economic crisis, which has kept them inward looking, and they don't have a particularly robust or coordinated foreign policy stance ever. The Chinese, who have a constructive role to play potentially in the future, aren't ready to assume that role right now. The Russians are clearly playing a rogue role. And the result is that a lot of the stabilizing forces that either involve these powers directly or through international mechanisms require their involvement aren't really working in the world. And local actors are trying to take advantage of that. Now, having said that, you can't let the President of the United States off the hook. He has been passive. He has been reluctant to get involved. And in a number of situations, he has embraced policies that are just wrong or aren't working. I think in each of the cases that you mentioned, Libya, Egypt, Gaza, Syria, Iraq, in Afghanistan, in the South China Sea, in parts of Africa, there are all things the United States could have done to mobilize our allies, to be a more robust leader, to provide more aid, to apply more pressure, to support potential allies on the ground better, that we haven't done. And, you know, none of them involve boots on the ground. None of them involve the extreme kind of intervention that the president always says he's trying to avoid. They involve leadership and thoughtful application of foreign policy, and we're not getting that either.
And Aaron David Miller, what do you say to that? And let's take the Gaza situation in particular. We did an interview yesterday which chronicled Secretary of State John Kerry's year-long effort to broker a peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians. So it seems that there was a big effort put into it with, as we see, not very good results.
Yeah, I mean, David and I have had this conversation before. I'm much less optimistic that the so-called middle ground would have fundamentally altered the trajectory of any of these conflicts, frankly. I just don't believe it. And that combined with the reality that I don't think we understand the world. I mean, we think the world is freed from the traditional forces of history and geography that motivate so many of these actors. You know, John Kerry says that Vladimir Putin is behaving as if he was still living in the 19th century in a 21st century world where presumably all nations have a stake in one another's success and should behave rationally. But the reality is that we may have freed ourselves from the forces of history and geography. You know, we have non-predatory neighbors to our north and south and literally fish to our east and west, you know, what one historian called our liquid assets. This puts us in an anomalous and unique position. The Russians haven't freed themselves from the forces of history and geography. The Chinese haven't. The Iranians haven't. The Egyptians haven't. The Israelis haven't. The Palestinians haven't. And we believe wrongly that somehow we can fix everything. Gaza and the peace process, an area I know best, are poster children for the naivety of American foreign policy. John Kerry undertook 10 months ago a well-intentioned effort to bridge the gaps between two parties that were fundamentally unbridgeable. I mean, I've watched this Arab-Israeli negotiation for 30 years, and I participated in a lot of failed efforts to resolve it. And I just think right now there simply is no solution, and we don't have one either for the ongoing conflict in Gaza. So on that one, I just don't agree
that there could have been something that we could have done. Exactly. David, what do you say? I mean, what could the United States have done in that situation? We had a brief window of opportunity last year.
First of all, I'm not under the illusion that the United States can solve any problem individually, and I'm also not under the illusion that you know many of the problems that the world faces can be solved. Many of these things have been festering for a long time. Some of the problems that we're talking about have been festering for decades. A number of the problems we've been talking about have been festering for centuries. And so to think that somehow we can go in and resolve them is foolhardy. To think that we, as the world's lone remaining superpower, with more alliances at our disposal than any other country, with huge economic levers at our disposal and significant military resources at our disposal, could play a more active and constructive leadership role in a lot of these situations and pursue a path that's different from what we've taken in a lot of these situations is also a perfectly reasonable thing to accept. And if you go into Libya and you stir things up, then you ought to have a plan for what happens when you get rid of Gaddafi that isn't just let's leave the country to its own devices. If there are potential allies on the ground in Syria who could stabilize and contain Assad and could have stopped ISIS when it was essentially a street gang before it became a militarized army with its own country, I think we could have done that. I think we could have remained engaged in the political situation in Iraq. Now, you may notice that I'm sort of tiptoeing around the Gaza issue because I think that's one where there's a less likelihood, given the nature of Israel and given the nature of the divided Palestinian authorities, for us to have made a big effect. Having said that, I think that Secretary Kerry made an error in trying to deal with the Qataris, who are essentially the sponsors of Hamas. You know, expecting them to solve this problem is like expecting a tobacco company to help you solve your smoking problem. They are the problem, and I think that, or part of the problem in any event. And at the same time, I think that our failure to have embraced a sort of more sensible, reasonable policy in Egypt, our failures in maintaining and managing our relationships with Israel, our failure to heed the advice of some of our dependable allies in the region, whether it's Jordan or the more moderate Gulf states, has weakened our ability to mobilize action here and has weakened our influence and has left us isolated. And so it's all relative. It's not could we have achieved peace, it's could we have done better. And in all of these cases, I think we could have done better.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf. He's editor of the Foreign Policy Group, and Aaron David Miller, a distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center. And Aaron David Miller, to you now, how much of an issue is the president's personality when it comes to these foreign crises and the fact that he has not a good relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu, for example, or Vladimir Putin, another example, and his aversion, as you said at the outset of this interview, to risk and to getting involved?
You know, it's national interest, frankly, not personal interest. If the national interest is there, if there's a confluence of needs and requirements between the parties, if there's opportunity. You know, Woody Allen said that 80% of success of life is just showing up. He's wrong. Success in life is showing up at the right time. And timing is everything. I mean, in my judgment, we haven't had a serious foreign policy in this country since the first Bush administration and an eminently talented Secretary of State under James Baker. And they only had a four-year run. They understood the relationship between means and ends. It certainly wasn't perfect, at times not pretty. But the reality is America was admired, feared, and respected during those years, in large part because we were succeeding, and we were succeeding in part because we knew what we were doing. You had a Secretary of State who actually was a not just a good negotiator, a brilliant one, and whose back was covered by his friend, personal friend, George H.W. Bush. And you had a set of opportunities, some historic in nature. And we projected our political power and our military power, first Gulf War, wisely and effectively. We have been failing in peacemaking and war making, frankly, since.
Could you argue, though, that that was not an uncomplicated time, but a simpler time, pre-9/11,
yes,
pre-Iraq
yes.
War?
100%. No. So I think it was a much simpler time.
One could hardly call the period in which George H.W. Bush was president as a simpler time. We had the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the paradigm that had actually been the operative paradigm in the world, and somehow they had to manage it. They had to do so in the context of a time in which you also had Tiananmen and a major change taking place within China, and on top of that, you had the first Gulf War. So that's hardly a simpler time than we are in today. Secondly, people do matter. The relationships within an administration matter. The relationships between presidents and world leaders matter. The degree to which they engage, they use the force of their personality, they're actively involved, all matter. How they manage their teams, how they empower their teams, all matter. And right now you have a president who is disengaged, who has proven himself not to be either a very good manager or a man who is extremely interested in managing, who has not empowered his cabinet terribly well, but has kept a lot of power concentrated in the White House and has watched his national security staff bloat to almost twice the level it was under the Bush administration, and one who literally at this point does not have the ability to point to really any significant international partnerships where he has the kind of one-on-one relationship with a foreign leader that you would want to see a president have, and which past presidents have had many, many. So it does matter who's president. It's not the only factor, but it's a really important one.
David Rothkopf is editor of the Foreign Policy Group and author of the forthcoming book, National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. And we also heard from Aaron David Miller, distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center, author also of a forthcoming book. It's called The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Okay, so what do you think? Should America be more involved in the world's problems or less? Do we have an obligation to be the world's cop? Leave us a message at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, and we might play your message later on in the show. Coming up on the show, cracking Hollywood's glass ceiling, we talk with the woman who wrote the script for the superhero action flick Guardians of the Galaxy. That's after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Of the 250 biggest films last year, just 10% were written by women. Just one example of something known as the celluloid ceiling. 6% of the movies had women directors, 3% had women cinematographers. But one of the biggest releases of this summer is helping to break through that ceiling for women screenwriters.
So here we are. A thief. Two thugs, an assassin, and a maniac. But we're not gonna stand by as evil wipes out the galaxy. I guess we're stuck together, partners.
Guardians of the Galaxy comes out this weekend. It's a Marvel superhero epic with a sci-fi spin, and it was co-written by Nicole Perlman, who is here with me in the studio. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, my pleasure. First, let me get your reaction to those statistics that I just mentioned, especially when it comes to the writing side of things.
It's not very surprising, unfortunately. It's a it's sort of something that you notice. There's a lot of us wearing horn-rimmed eyeglasses, and not that many of us are women.
So. Yeah. So what is it like to try to break through and to say, look, you know, I'm qualified, I've got this great script, and, you know, you're talking to a bunch of white men?
I think it's interesting. Usually the writing stands for itself, but when you're in a pitch situation where you are kind of putting on a show for what you would like to do with a project, I think it comes into play a little bit more there, because they're taking more on faith that you will be able to pull off what you say you're going to do. Whereas if it's on the page and people love what's already written, I think it's a lot easier. But so much of this business is pitching and people, you know, taking a risk on a new person and on a new voice. So in that regard, I would say that women have a little bit more stacked against them if they're writing in a genre that's not typically, you know, a romantic comedy or a genre of that sort.
Which is what you're doing.
Yes.
So how did you manage to break through? And I mean, this is not just a little movie for your first film that, not the first film that you've written, but the first film that's been produced that you've written. This is a major blockbuster.
Yeah, it's kind of doesn't get bigger than this, which is amazing that this is the first project that that's been produced of mine. Most of my scripts before that had been much smaller biopics, projects about scientists or space in some way. And this has been kind of my niche from the beginning. I've never been able to really see myself as a romantic comedy writer. And people have sent me books and said, "This, you know, we'd be interested in having you adapt this." And I said, you know, I'm not really going to do a great job on this project. I tend to gravitate towards projects that are less stereotypically feminine. So sometimes that works against you, sometimes it works for you, but I've been pretty consistent in staying true to my geeky roots.
Uh-huh. And so in this case, why were you picked, do you think?
I think I was picked because, you know, there was a program at Marvel that was looking to foster people wanting to develop their lesser-known properties. So for a short period of time, Marvel had this situation where they hired 4 or 5 writers, and we each got a campus office, and we got to choose from a list of, you know, maybe half a dozen different properties that Marvel was interested in potentially making one day. It wasn't 100% sure, but I chose Guardians on the list, and I think maybe people were a little surprised by that, because there were female lead characters, and there were characters that were better known, and I went for the one with the talking raccoon.
Really? Was that the appeal?
Yeah. Well, I think it was that it was most the most science fiction oriented. And I really wanted to take that step from focusing purely on, you know, engineering, technology, astronauts and biopics and these things that I love. And I sort of grew up with going to a larger science fiction realm, a lot more popcorn. And I think also it's hard to, in Hollywood, it can be hard to get people to take a risk on a big budget science fiction film if you're untested and you don't have any experience in that genre, and especially as a woman, I think. So that's why I leapt at the chance to go for Guardians.
You know, often these big movies, they have lots and lots of writers and they go through various iterations of scripts and that kind of thing. How true to your vision is the final product?
I think it's very true to my vision. It has the characters that I chose for the team, because a lot of people don't realize, since Guardians doesn't have a huge following as a comic, that there are dozens of Guardians characters. Over the years, there have been many characters who come in and off the team. So sort of choosing which characters I wanted to focus on with the movie, what the relationships were, rebooting Peter Quill's backstory, which is different than it was in the comics.
And who's Peter Quill?
Oh, he's the protagonist. He's our dashing lead, played by Chris Pratt. So
Chris Pratt from Parks and Rec?
That's right, yeah. So I think that there's quite a bit that made it to the screen, and I'm very happy with it.
Yeah. And so you say there are lots of characters, so that says to me that there could be lots of sequels.
Oh, definitely.
This could be a franchise.
I think so. I think that based on the reaction that people have been having to the movie so far, I'd be surprised if we didn't have a sequel at some point in the Marvel slate, in the upcoming Marvel slate.
And you said that your specific interest is in science fiction and in science and technology and in doing those kinds of biopics. Mm-hmm. And is that something that you've been drawn to since you were young, that you've been interested in science? And how did you get into this in the first place?
Well, it's interesting. My background is from Boulder, Colorado, is where my family is right now. And my father ran a science fiction book club. So I grew up with all these aerospace scientists from the Boulder, Colorado region and rocket scientists coming over to our house and talking about sci-fi they were reading and physicists they had studied under at Caltech or MIT. And I kind of just absorbed it and absorbed the stories that they were telling. And one of the stories they told me about was Richard Feynman and what it was like to have classes with the great Richard Feynman. And I became a little bit obsessed with Richard Feynman. My dad got me the books, his autobiographies, for my 16th birthday, and I had a big crush on this dead physicist. So all my friends had pictures of, pop stars and Keanu Reeves on their wall, and I had these grainy Caltech printouts from their website on my walls of Richard Feynman playing the bongo drums. So that was kind of how I got into it, was having a crush on a dead physicist. So.
And didn't you write a biopic about him?
I did. Yeah, I did. So, which may have life in it yet. It just got reoptioned. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. So how do these things, live and die? This one in particular, I think it went pretty far, wasn't it? About the Challenger?
It did. Yeah, it had quite a lifespan. I wrote it actually when I was back in college, and it was the launching point for a lot of my career, actually. And it had several directors attached, several actors attached. But that is a tale of woe that will curl your hair if I tell you that story.
I kind of want my hair curled.
It went through a lot of different issues with various chain of title that needed to be cleared. And just when we got the rights back, the original financing company went into bankruptcy court, and we had to buy the rights back after they got out. And it took a year. All these things happen. This is a very common tale of woe.
So given the fact that you went through years trying to deal with this and trying to get that made and other projects as well, and then all of a sudden, here comes this other thing, Guardians of the Galaxy. I mean, did you just think, what's happening here? How did this happen? Maybe not easily, but more easily than these other projects.
Well, it's kind of amazing that a project that is such a huge budget blockbuster, that is a really big risk in the sense that it doesn't have a lot of public knowledge, or pre-knowledge of who these characters are, became the thing that happened first compared to a very low budget movie that that I think is very tellable and very relevant. But I'm thrilled that it happened, and I'm excited about Guardians. And it would be very, very funny to me if Guardians and Challenger both came out, you know, within a reasonable amount of time to each other, because it shows that you know, women can write all sorts of things. They can write small biopics about scientists, and they can write big blockbusters with talking raccoons. I think it's nice to be able to stretch the genre in that way.
You know, women are very well represented in other writing professions.
Yes.
Journalism, for example. Mm. Literature, for another example. But so why is it that in Hollywood they're so underrepresented?
That's a really good question. I think Hollywood tends to be a little bit more old school in some senses. I think that women, even though women were screenwriters back in the old MGM studio system days, it's the movies that get made most easily tend to be comedies and action movies and thrillers. And these genres don't have a lot of women writers in them. And I don't know necessarily that it is just a function of women not being given a shot. I think that women don't tend to gravitate towards that as much, maybe because they think it will be harder for them to sell it, or because they're not encouraged to write in these genres. And I know just as many women who love science fiction as men, and I know just as many women who love thrillers as men, but for some reason, I haven't met that many women screenwriters who are working in the genre, and it's something that I would like to change.
And how do you change that?
I think it's a perception thing. I think it's just knowing that it's not that hard to break in once you have something out there. I think it's I never had anything else on my slate that I was trying to sell that was different. I think this was, you know, maybe in some ways it helped that I was a woman, because that was a bit of a novelty to it. But I do look forward to the day when it's not, you know, women as a novelty writing outside in their genre. I think it's something that we have to make normal and have it be an unremarkable thing that women are writing comic books and women are writing comic book movies. I think that some of the best work that's being done right now in comic books is being done by women. A friend of mine, Willow Wilson, has rebooted Ms. Marvel as a Muslim teenage girl, and it's selling, you know, gangbusters, and it's doing really well and getting great reviews. And I think that every time something like that happens, it makes it easier for women to make inroads in these genres. And so hopefully Guardians will be somewhat like that.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And congratulations.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Nicole Perlman co-wrote Guardians of the Galaxy. It comes out in theaters this weekend. Are you a woman working in Hollywood? Are you bumping up against the celluloid ceiling? We'd love to hear about it. You can call 1-844-PRESS-PLAY and leave us a message, or you can join the conversation on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Warren Olney is a man working in radio, and he has a show coming up at 1 o'clock.
I do indeed, and we'll be talking about Ebola, the virus we're now seeing in three West African countries, the worst outbreak of Ebola since it was discovered in 1976. 670 people dead, 1,000 or so infected. And what's really serious about it is that it's actually crossed national boundaries for the first time and gotten into some of the big cities as well, so it's not just isolated in rural areas anymore. But there are reassuring things about the outbreak, to the extent that you can be reassured about any outbreak, and we'll talk about those too.
All right, that is coming up at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Olney, and coming up on this program, why the hashtag #unfollowmen has blown up on Twitter and why the dating site OkCupid is messing with your love life. The TLDR guys are here to talk about the latest internet news. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. You guys, total score. He's cute. He's got a job, and he's a 98% match. 98%, but wait. Oh my gosh, it says here he believes trees have spirits. He's preparing for the zombie apocalypse, and he has a bathroom selfie. Ugh. Okay, so that's a dramatic reenactment. No OkCupid for me, but anyone who's ever been on that dating site, OkCupid, knows what I'm talking about. How on earth can someone be matched up with someone who is so obviously not right for them? Well, now we know OkCupid's been running experiments on users that futz with the matching results. Joining us to talk about this and other internet-related news are the two guys behind the WNYC podcast, TLDR, and that stands for Too Long, Didn't Read, in internet speak. PJ Vogt and Alex Goldman, welcome back, you guys.
Hey.
Hey.
Okay, tell us about these experiments.
Well, the OkCupid folks posted a blog post, I think, yesterday or Monday. They posted a blog post on Monday, which basically said that they were doing an experiment where they tried telling people who were actually algorithmically very poorly matched, say they got a 30% match on their shared characteristics, and the characteristics are based on an almost endless list of questions that you can answer when you're setting up your profile. They told people who had very little in common that they were actually great matches. So people who had 30% match, they said they were 90% matches, and those people ended up theoretically going on dates with one another.
Well, why would OkCupid do that?
Their argument is that it helps improve their product, that they want to make sure that what they're doing is not just providing people a totally random sampling that has nothing to do with the quality of your shared interests, but rather their algorithm actually works to some degree.
Okay, the CEO of OkCupid, he was on ATC, All Things Considered, last night, and really not apologetic.
You know, I went to Harvard and William James Hollis, where they do all these psychology experiments. You need $20. You're like, sure, I'll go sign up for something. And you sign a form. You have no idea what the experiment is. And so you, because if there is information, it ruins the experiment. So this kind of good old days of past research standards, I don't even think it doesn't pertain even there, you know?
Okay, so he is not apologizing for experimenting on OkCupid users. Does he have a point that we should just, it's buyer beware, that we should assume that we are being experimented all the time when we go online?
Well, I guess it sort of depends on who you talk to. I mean, for the people at the tech companies, what they say is every website does A/B testing. Every website tries different versions, shows it to different groups of users, and tries to decide which is best.
I mean, A/B testing can mean anything from sending you on a bad date, which seems fairly malicious. Not malicious, but duplicitous.
Malicious.
Okay, fine. Malicious. To, you know, changing font size or changing picture size. There are things that help us interface better with a website, and then there are things that fundamentally deceive us into committing acts that we would not have done otherwise.
Well, I wonder, though, from a business perspective, if that's a good idea to be honest about the fact that your product isn't honest, you know, to basically say, you know, we're a dating algorithm and our success is based on its ability to match people well. And here we're saying, you know what, we're actually not doing that.
Totally. I mean, it feels like it would drive everyone screaming from your website. But similarly with the Facebook admitting that they had experimented on their users without their users' consent or knowledge, there's not a ton of other options. Yeah, there are other dating sites, but what OkCupid would say is they're doing these experiments too. We just tell you about them. And I have to say, as someone who should know better, someone who covers this stuff and thinks about this stuff and has misgivings about this stuff, I use Facebook and OkCupid knowing that I could very well be a guinea pig in their giant, mysterious experiments.
There was one which I found kind of amusing, and that is they took the photos away from people, the images.
Yeah, I remember that day. There's a day where you signed on and you couldn't see what anyone looked like. And they said way more people were talking to each other. Of the people who stayed on the site, there was way more conversation. But as soon as they flicked the proverbial lights on, a lot of those conversations abruptly ended.
Okay, well, let's move on. This weekend, a BuzzFeed writer, her name is Katie Notopoulos, started a movement called Unfollow a Man, hashtag Unfollow a Man. What is that?
Oh, it's so great. So Katie is just a very smart, funny internet writer, and she's been doing an experiment of her own for the last 6 months where she unfollowed all the men that she followed on Twitter. She said that what happened was she sort of looked at her feeds and realized that she just followed this crazy preponderance of men and that male opinion online tends to be loud and dominant and inescapable. And she just wanted to see what it would look like. And so 6 months later, she has said that this has been a good experiment for her and that sort of half tongue-in-cheek, sort of not, she's suggesting everybody at least unfollow one man on social media.
And this is because she wants to get a better conversation going in her Twitter feed?
I think she also wants to make a point that men's rights activists online are humorless, easily aggravated trolls, and this campaign has made that point really well. The response has been as if she proposed, I don't know, reinstituting segregation. Like, people are apoplectic about it.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, people are doing a very good job of making her point for her.
I actually tweeted when it happened, I'm super stoked. I'm looking at my Twitter feed. I'm super stoked to unfollow a man right now. I think it'll probably be PJ. And then I followed that by saying, to be clear, I'm also eligible for unfollow a man. And if you're thinking about participating, think about unfollowing me.
Did people do that?
People unfollow me pretty regularly. My Twitter account is nothing to crow about. I mean, it's impossible. I don't know who. You don't know who follows.
Some of us do closely track who unfollows us, and some women did unfollow me.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how did you feel about that?
That's super narcissistic.
Well, I am super narcissistic, and I hate being unfollowed. But we're two guys doing a show about the internet. I feel like our overwhelming maleness and the limits of our perspective is something that I notice and grapple with. I think sometimes it's good for me to shut up or be shut up.
And it's not just that it's not just the behavior of men. It's more like the volume of men's voices just seems like it's so much louder. Am I right about that, PJ? He's quiet.
He's been
right
quiet. I'm going to refollow you.
Do you disagree with my premise? Is that why you were so quiet?
No, I agree with your premise.
Okay.
You guys are talking a lot, and I want to get in here, okay? You're just dominating the conversation, and I just don't feel like you're listening. Okay, so let's talk about this other thing. Speaking of Twitter, and I don't know how I feel about this. I think it's kind of mean, but I think you have a different opinion. This guy, Corey Archangel, the artist, has published a novel where he's publishing people's tweets about them working on a novel.
Yeah, the idea is he started a Twitter feed for a long time that was called Working on My Novel, and it's just a curated retweets of people saying, I'm working on my novel, and they can either be bragging about it and saying, like, I'm working on my novel, so I can't talk right now, I'm logging off, or they're saying, it's been 3 years since I picked up my novel, but I'm going to start working on my novel again. I believe I can finish it this year. And there's something I find really wonderful about it. It feels like, PJ?
What do you find wonderful about it?
It just is a totem of this idea that we love to talk about all the stuff that we're working on, whereas we're actually on Twitter. You can't be on Twitter and working on your novel.
Yeah. You can.
You totally can.
You need to take a little bit of a break now and then.
Yeah, like, and it's such a, I don't know, I agree with you that I think it's a little mean. It feels like what is snootier than making art out of making fun of people's attempts to make art?
I think that you are overlaying a comment on it that is not necessarily there. There are some of those tweets I found profoundly affecting. It really resonates with me as someone who likes to create things for all the times that I've tried. Like, I empathize with those people.
Do you think that he is empathizing, or is he just making fun of them?
I don't think that art is about what the artist intends.
No.
What a dodge.
I'm now going to unfollow you just for that comment.
I strongly recommend you do. What a wimp.
I don't think that he's trying to make fun of them.
Really? You think that this is just, he's just empathetically highlighting all these people trying and failing?
I have no idea, but I don't think, it didn't seem mean-spirited to me. There's no comment related
to
it.
Well, at least he's completed his book, so he can just look at that and say, look, at least I did a book.
I completely agree. I think it's art as na-na-na-na-na.
I guess that I just, you know, believe in people's better nature than more so than you guys do. I'm being so obnoxious.
You are. Okay, I think we're going to end it there. Look, I've seized control.
Just a reminder, guys, unfollow a man day.
It can be every day.
PJ Vogt, Alex Goldman, producers for WNYC's On the Media, and they host the podcast TLDR. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks. Thank you.
Jolie Myers is here with mail. Hello.
I've got the OK Mail. I have to say, OK Cupid, that's such a terrible name for a dating site. It's like, why not call it Meh Cupid or mediocre Cupid. I get the Cupid part, but maybe be a little bit more ambitious. Like, great Cupid.
Yes, Cupid.
Absolutely Cupid. But alas, they're going to stick with it, I think. Brand recognition. And I'd like to say that I'm just going to chalk up all of my OKCupid disaster dates to experiments. Now I have a really good explanation of what went wrong. So also on our internet segment today, a quick tweet relevant to all of that is from Chris Mahoney on the Unfollow a Man movement. Mm-hmm. He says, I wish there was some way to tell who was the most unfollowed man as a result of Unfollow a Man, the campaign. I feel like if he can figure that out, he gets a follow. I'll go ahead and follow him. And the vitriol, if you go on Cupid and actually check out this hashtag, it is so there. It is so everywhere. People are furious. But I think that my favorite tweets are the ones in which men offer themselves up to be unfollowed. I find that completely charming. So who needs OKCupid? I could just find the guys that are trying to be unfollowed on Twitter.
I think that is a reverse psychology that's happening right there. I'm going to
take the cynical point of view
on that one.
And everyone, we are gender neutral-ish on at KCRW Press Play. So go ahead and follow us. No need to unfollow us. We also talked today about America's role in the world, our foreign policy, and listener Bree from Long Beach called in. Here's what she had to say.
Concerning Barack Obama as president and his international policy, it is relatively weak. However, he came at a time when we were sick and tired of international conflict and we wanted to get our own economy in line. And I think that now we're kind of seeing some of the effects of that, which have been obviously very negative, but aren't entirely his fault given he tried to give the people what they wanted.
So you get what you vote for is what Bree's trying to say here.
Right, and that happens so often after large wars that there's a period of retrenchment. And then it all starts all over again.
That's what we're doing right after the show. Retrenchment.
Retrenchment. Jolie Myers, thank you very much. If you want to weigh in on anything you've heard on this program, we'd love to hear from you. Our Twitter is at KCRW Press Play, Facebook, KCRW's Press Play. Warren Olney is up next with To The Point. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.